We often feel like we are living in an overwhelming age of anxiety. But the problem isn't having too much anxiety. It's that we don't know well enough how to feel anxious and to put anxiety to good use. We have learned to mistake even healthy anxiety for a danger that we use to protect ourselves from, or a disease to prevent and eradicate at all cost. But this view unintentionally intensifies anxiety even further and prevents us from seeing the truth. Anxiety isn't a failure. It isn't a malfunction. It's a triumph of evolution, helping us imagine and plan for the uncertainty of the future. All the while, it's making us more persistent, more creative, and more socially connected. My guest today, Tracy Dennis Tiwari, is the author of Future Tense. And in her new book, she shows why we all need this difficult emotion, where we went wrong, and how we can flip the script and use anxiety to the advantage that it evolved to be. Mental health is not an absence of anxiety. Mental health is the ability to be anxious in ways that help us, to help us work with and through anxiety when it's not helping us, and to be curious enough about anxiety to learn to know the difference. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show. Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Tracy Dennis Tiwari is the author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. She is a professor of psychology and neuroscience and the director of the Emotional Regulation Lab at the City University of New York. She is also the founder and CSO of Wise Therapeutics, where she translates neuroscience and cognitive therapy techniques into gamified, clinically validated digital therapeutics for mental health. She has published more than 100 scientific articles and has delivered more than 400 presentations at academic conferences and for corporate clients. She has been featured throughout the media, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, ABC, CBS, CNN, NPR, The Today Show, and Bloomberg Television. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you, Lindsay. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
I am so excited to chat with you today because anxiety is everywhere. It is so prevalent, and we know that anxiety disorders affect a solid 18% of the U.S. population. We're talking millions and millions of adults, and we're seeing really highly escalating levels in children as well. And we know that true mental health is not the absence of anxiety, and mental health is about the ability to be anxious in ways that help us. Because I was just talking with Dr. Gregory Scott Brown, and I said, you know, one of the best things about being a human is being able to experience the entire range of emotions. And what you're saying in your new book, Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad, is that anxiety can help to spur you on. It can really help us in different ways. And we just have to be curious enough about our anxiety to understand how to know the difference. And so talk to us a little bit first about what is anxiety and what is it not?
Thank you, Lindsay. And boy, you really nailed it. I almost don't have to say anything else.
thank you.
Because the whole purpose of the book is really to change the conversation about anxiety. And I think these points you raised are crucial to that. And then starting with definitions is really important. So let's first distinguish between anxiety and fear. And then I also want to distinguish anxiety from anxiety disorders. And it really was important you started with sort of the scope of the problem when it comes to anxiety disorder. So anxiety and fear. So anxiety, we know what it feels like most of the time. It feels like fear. It's that butterflies in the stomach. It's this response we think of as freeze, fight, or flight. But fear is very distinct because it's the feeling we get when we know we're in clear and present danger in the moment, and it's certain. It's, you know, the snake about to bite you. And so it has to do with the present tense and with certainty and danger. But anxiety has nothing to do with the present moment. And anxiety is actually all about uncertainty. So what anxiety does is it makes us into these mental time travelers into the future. It's this feeling we get, this nervous apprehension about the uncertainty we face in the future, where something bad could happen or something good could happen. It's like being anxious about that big job interview or podcast you're doing the next day. And you're thinking, okay, I could totally bomb this and it could be terrible, or I could crush it and it could be an amazing experience. Anxiety is that feeling that tells you that both possibilities exist and prepares you to avert disaster and make, you know, in kind of a cheesy way of saying it, but make your dreams come true, make those positive outcomes into reality.
So
fear really is only about threat, and anxiety is also about hope and possibility.
Oh, I love that so much. You know, I love the phrase, fear says, what if I botch the interview? What if this all goes wrong? But faith says, even if, and that's what you're saying, is like, anxiety is showing you that, like, you could win the contest or you could lose. You know, and that's just part of the human experience and things. And so what made you, I love what you said about fear is momentary. We have to have moments of fear. I remember just recently I had something very fearful. It happened in my life. I was driving down the road and I see this woman and she's about to walk into oncoming traffic.
I
was like, what do I do? And I stopped the car and I stopped oncoming traffic and I'm like, ma'am, what's going on? Like, come to me. And, you know, turn around, and trigger warning, audience. And her poor little puppy had gotten hit by a car and she was coming after him. But that moment of like profound fear, putting my arms up in the middle of a highway, like 60 miles an hour, and just declaring, I have to have this traffic must stop. That's a profound moment of fear versus anxiety. It's sounding like, or you say, is you're saying like, it's giving you that hope. It's giving you like the moment of like, what's happening next.
That's right. Because you're not sure. And that's why that's why anxiety is the word that we put on the times we're going through now, because it's uncertain. I mean, what describes the pandemic and everything we've been through the past few years more than uncertainty? Mm-hmm. I love too that as we think about that, you know, leaning into uncertainty, anxiety has to be uncomfortable. It exists in that space that it's a bridge between where we are now and where we want to be. Mm-hmm. So you're only anxious when you care. When we're anxious, we're not despairing yet. We're in it to win it. And just like that beauty, you know, that story, that, you know, frightening but beautiful story of how you, you know, you went to that woman, you leaned towards that woman who was in this dangerous situation. Your fear helped you suss out what was happening and respond. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've evolved to have these uncomfortable emotions. I'm sure that was not a comfortable experience for you.
No.
But it had to make you sit up and pay attention. And anxiety does that for us when it comes to uncertainty, when it comes to possibility. Anxiety actually makes us more creative for that same reason. So there's this great study, for example, by researchers DeDrew and colleagues from 2008. And what they did is they made people feel a little anxious. So they might have told the story like what you just told. Like as you were speaking, I was feeling more anxiety. They had people recall something anxiety provoking that happened to them. And then they had them do a problem solving task where they had to think outside the box, be innovative, do really work hard at this difficult problem solving. And what they found is that people who were made to feel more anxious, they persisted longer, they had more ideas and higher quality of ideas. Because anxiety is this activating emotion that mm-hmm. sends us, it springs us forward. Now, it's like a wave in that sense, right? So you can drown in a wave. I know, and no one wants to feel anxious. It's a terrible emotion. But it activates and energizes us. So we can drown in it, but we can also swim. We can surf it. And what if we start to shift our attitude about anxiety, not always as a disease or a malfunction, but as a messy part of being human, we can start to build those skills to work with it and go through it rather than around it.
My colleague Ben Perkis always says emotions are like waves and no wave lasts forever. Just ride the wave until you get to the other side.
Waves are a great metaphor for that reason too. It's exactly right.
Exactly, exactly. And I also, what you're saying also reminds me of Sheryl Sandberg's work, Option B, where, you know, she's talking about grief, but I feel like anxiety can be the same thing. Anxiety can lie to you in three different ways by telling you everything is terrible. Everything is not terrible. Some of the things are terrible. It will always be terrible. Nope. Emotions are like waves and no wave lasts forever. And it's my fault that it's terrible. No, no, no. None of those things are true. And so compare and contrast for us, going back to this anxiety versus fear, you called your book Future Tense. And my guess is that's in direct, like, as opposed to fear, which is present tense. So why did you choose to call it Future Tense?
I call it Future Tense because it amplifies one of the most important points I'm trying to make, which is that anxiety is leveraging one of the achievements, one of the highest achievements of human evolution, which is to be able to think about and prepare for the future. So, and it does make that distinction with fear too. So it's saying, you know, anxiety can, you know, tell you the wrong things, but the very first thing we have to understand is that it can tell us something. There's information to be listened to. The times that we tend to go wrong with anxiety are often those times that we refuse to listen to it. Mm-hmm. That we actually reject it, we suppress it. So we have this disease story of anxiety that's priming us to treat anxiety like a malfunction or disease. So what do? We suppress it, we avoid it, we take it as a call to panic instead of a call to listen and to tune in, to turn towards. And so when we start to actually listen to anxiety and what it tells us about future possibilities, it's not just protective, it's actually actively productive, like the creativity I mentioned to you, but also we don't realize, but what a scientific fact is that when we're anxious, it actually triggers the release of dopamine in our brain. And dopamine is the feel-good hormone, which not just happens when there's, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but also when we're primed to achieve our goals. So it actually is helping us work towards things we want in the world. When we're anxious, we have more oxytocin coursing through our veins as well. And that's the social bonding hormone. So in that sense, anxiety primes us to seek out social connection and support, which is one of the best ways to work through anxiety. Mm-hmm. So it's not just this kind of evolutionarily outdated, like just a battle of the saber-toothed tiger kind of a feeling. It's a feeling that prepares us to act, to engage, and to really power through obstacles that we might face in our life.
Oh, it's so, you know, I mean, I've mentioned this to my audience before, but what you're saying reminds me of Lovheim's cube of emotions, where he puts on an XYZ axis, norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine. And depending on the balance of all of those, you know, you can have hugely high levels of dopamine and serotonin and norepinephrine. And we perceive that as surprise, you know? And so what you're saying is so applicable to our lives because, yeah, we may be anxious, but the anxiety is driving us towards these dopaminergic responses, which can be perceived as fear, but can also be perceived as excitement and joy and oxytocin. I mean, goodness gracious, we even have hard-coded it in our language. We know that when we go through a collective anxiety-inducing experience with a group of people, you are so bonded to those people. I mean, I think about the people I went to pharmacy school with. That was real stressful for a real long time. And you know, too, I'm sure you'll never forget your mentors that helped you to achieve your PhD because the anxiety caused oxytocin production to create that that bond. And how evolutionary is that? Of course, we create safety in numbers when we are anxious. It just makes evolutionary sense. So talk to us, you know, we talk a lot on the show about the medicalization of many different disease states, the medicalization of women's health, the medicalization of mental health, and all of these things. And so you mentioned that, you know, anxiety is not just one thing. There's all different types of anxiety. And so talk to us a little bit about why thinking of anxiety as a disease is just broken and is really truly doing us harm.
That's right. I think that we, you know, as you know, having thought a lot about medicalization of mental health and all sorts of things, it was really over decades and in some cases hundreds of years, it's with the goal to validate, right, this way of thinking about a problem or solving a problem and to say, hey, we want to recognize that there's this category of distress called mental health distress or mental, you know, mental illness. And we want to understand it, analyze it, deconstruct it, and then treat it. So this is the intention. But the problem with the disease metaphor is, well, what do you do with a disease like cancer, like COVID? You prevent it, you eradicate it, you suppress it, which is exactly the wrong thing to do when it comes to difficult emotions like anxiety, because that is a recipe for these emotions to always bounce back stronger. Mm. And an opportunity cost to learn how to actually cope with and work with these feelings. So that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that when we feel these difficult emotions, we assume something's wrong, broken, it's a malfunction, which means we have to make it go away and fix it. And so it's a huge opportunity cost also in not just learning to cope, but to learn about these potentials that we just talked about the kind of gifts that feeling these emotions can give us. It also muddies the water and gives us fewer opportunities to tell the difference between healthy anxiety as an emotion and an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a good time to make that distinction. So I might experience, you know, high levels of anxiety on a daily basis, but I will not be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder unless my ways of coping with that anxiety start to cause functional impairment or getting in the way of living my life well. So if I have social anxieties, I might feel nervous before I talk with a wonderful podcaster or before I, you know, do something challenging in my life. I'll feel the anxiety. It might cause distress, but I will still be able to work through it and do it. If I have social anxiety disorder, I might start refusing to go on the podcast. I might stop going to work. I might lose opportunities and all of a sudden, and then I'm cutting off from my friends and I'm not leaving the house. Mm-hmm. So it's these ways of coping, not the emotion of anxiety itself, that's really the crisis. And yeah. So when one says, you know, we can still think of anxiety as an ally to negotiate with, yes, like any ally, rather than an enemy, that doesn't discount that people can get into vicious cycles of anxiety disorders, which are all about this unhelpful cycles of coping that start to make anxiety spiral out of control. But when we stop demonizing anxiety as the problem and instead think about that link between our feelings and how we cope with them, which is the target of therapy anyway,
right,
that helps us start to kind of lose some of these negative implications of the disease story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about last night. So last night we had major flash floodings across central Alabama. And, you know, I woke up to what sounds like thunderous, you know, thunder and just like the really, you know, like when lightning is striking and it's striking right on top of you. And, you know, I had a moment where I either could have gotten up and gotten stressed and wrung my hands, or do I take the dog bed and go downstairs to the basement and sleep in that safer bed instead, knowing, you know, because the dog was running over to the bed and was like, Mom, you got to wake up. And so at first I just like brought her to right beside me, beside the bed. But that's what it sounds like you're saying is like, we all have situations that provoke anxiety, but it's about how do we use it. Before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. This episode of The Lindsay Elmore Show is sponsored by Sambucol. Fall will soon be here. And fall is a time when we get the chance to harvest all that we have sown all summer long. Mother Nature is shedding her layers as we layer up for cooler weather. Kids are heading back to school, and this is a time of transition. That means that it is the perfect time of year to assess your current routines. What is serving you? What isn't? And is there anything that can help to aid your health and wellness journey? This is where Sambucol comes in. I recently started taking Sambucol Black Elderberry every single morning to help support my immune system so that I can keep doing all of the things that I need to do every single day. It's a simple act of self-care that doesn't really take much effort. Sambucol is made from premium European black elderberries, which are a natural source of powerful antioxidants and key vitamins like A, C, and E. They help support a healthy immune system so that you can keep moving. Best of all, Sambucol has many different ways of helping your daily dose of black elderberry to happen with ease. There are syrups, gummies, chewable tablets, drink powders, capsules, and more. They have products just for kids, too. So whether you are drizzling a little bit of syrup over your yogurt or overnight oats, or if you're reminded every time you exercise, today is my time to take my Sambucol, go ahead and bump up that immunity so that you can keep moving. Listeners of The Lindsay Elmore Show can get 15% off of their next order of $9.99 or more at SambucolUSA.com by using my promo code Lindsay15 at checkout. That's 15% off your order of $9.99 or more at SambucolUSA.com when you shop the code LINDSEY and the number 15 at checkout. Here's a pro tip. Save this information in your notes app. Life gets busy and you are not going to want to scroll back through episodes and find me saying this again. The code is Lindsay15 at SambucolUSA.com. And now, let's get back to the show. And so, you know, we've talked about how anxiety can be a warning sign, you know, that something may be looming. But are there other ways that anxiety can benefit us?
I think of what I do in my life and what I see in many people around me as that I couldn't do what I do without some anxiety. So I'm a scientist. I'm a writer. These are all jobs. And you as a pharmacist, you know, if you didn't have a real focus on getting things right, on persisting through obstacles, on precision and details. Anxiety is part of our inner resource that allows us to focus and persist and be detail oriented and be a little obsessive.
Yeah.
And be right. You know, I talk to a lot of performers and art kind of creatives. And this, I think creative people understand anxiety on a level that many of us might not, because if they're, you know, they know that, you know, if they're a performer, stage fright is part of what they experience every time they go. If they're not throwing up in the bathroom before they go on stage for their big number or their big, they, you know, something's wrong, because what that's telling them is that their body, their mind is preparing to act, and they take it not as a signal of, you know, oh, I'm breaking down, but as a signal, I'm revving up.
Yeah.
And so just this mindset shift that we can practice, like performers do, like creatives do, we can practice using those signals. You know, when we face something really, something dangerous or potentially disastrous. My son was born with a congenital heart condition. Mm-hmm. And we found out when I was in the middle of my pregnancy. And it was, you know, he had to have open heart surgery when he was 4 months old. Mm-hmm. When I found out and I knew this was coming around the bend, my anxiety, it kept me from despairing. It helped me know that with hard work, with getting the right doctors, doing my research, you know, I got right onto PubMed and I started finding out about that, and, you know, getting his care in place. I was so grateful I found out in the middle of my pregnancy, because I used that anxiety to propel me forward and to keep being the best, you know, mom I could be to my, at that time, unborn son. And it's a happy story now. He's fine. He got great treatment. He had a successful open heart surgery, but it, you know, anxiety wasn't my enemy there. It helped me keep going and prepare and do all as many right things as I could do.
Absolutely. I mean, there's very few things, if any, as anxiety producing as a sick child, you know, because just the layers and layers of love and care and maternal instinct, the mom guilt, the mom, like all the things.
Even before you're a mom.
Even before you're a mom. I know. I mean, women guilt and shame themselves if they can't conceive. And like, it's part of a very strong evolutionary driver. And so, you know, but what you're saying is honestly, truly beautiful. It's beautiful to think that, like, yeah, I was so anxious that I spent whatever, 3 hours researching the best pediatric heart surgeons in the United States. Yes, I read all of the package inserts for the medications. And to your point, in my career, I have made, there are two situations in my practice as a pharmacist that I look back on that just ripped my heart out time after time after time. One was when I made a calculation error. I forgot to divide by three and I almost killed somebody. And so, yeah, like you better believe I was checking my math a bit more closely. And the second time, I was a pharmacy resident, and so I was brand new. It's my first year in practice. I've been in practice probably like 4 months at this point. And I get an order for fentanyl in a micro preemie withdrawing from heroin. And I'm 4 months into practice. And I'm like going around to everybody. And we're not a pediatric hospital. I have no training in pediatrics. And I mean, I'm going to every single pharmacist going, check my math, check my math, check my math, check my math, check my math. The nurses are calling me saying, like, you don't understand what we're going through with this baby right now. And I was like, you don't understand what I'm doing down here trying to get the right dose. Because if you're off by a factor of five, oh, Lord.
And thank God you had that anxious, you cared. That's why you were anxious.
Yes.
And thank goodness, you know?
Yes, I know.
And, right. And you know, and I love that story too, because it also, I think a big part of what my hope is for in writing this book and sharing its message is that we have to be a lot more forgiving towards ourselves for the mess, just the messy work of being human.
Yeah.
We're going to be anxious. Sometimes we're going to be overwhelmed by it. I know I'm talking about a lot of the benefits. but that's to also shift our story, because when we actually are curious and open and engage with this messy, difficult work of being human, all these difficult feelings like anxiety, we will be better able to work. You know, the only way out is through. We can work through it. We know that we're not as fragile as we sometimes fear. We are strong. Emotions are an anti-fragile system, like the immune system. You actually have to challenge the system to get it to work, to get it to mount a like muscles. You have to strain and work them or they're going to atrophy. And our emotions are the same way. So when we start to forgive ourselves these feelings, to know that mental health is not just the absence of all emotional discomfort, that it's actually the struggle in working through these difficult emotions. And then when we acknowledge, you know what, and sometimes it is all going to fall apart. Life gets the better of us. We can't always adjust, no matter what our mindset is, like, you know, and sometimes we're going to need that extra support. We're going to need to see a therapist. Maybe we will need medication for some period of time, but that's not a failure. And so when we stop thinking of anxiety, like cancer, which feels like that's a life-threatening disaster, and instead say, this is my journey of being human and I can build skills. And you don't build skills in getting cancer. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a different metaphor. It's more, we should think about anxiety and mental health like fitness.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? It's a skill to build. You work towards it. It's a journey. Mm-hmm. It's not a binary. You have it or you don't. You're a happy person or you're a mentally ill person. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's, I teach people a lot. We all have the same stuff. We all have fear. We all have dread. We all have like worry. We all have it because we're human. And as you're so beautifully talking about, like, why don't you just work with that and through that instead of trying to shove it out? And I'd love your opinion on medications, both the benzodiazepine type medications as well as the SSRIs and to some extent the other antidepressants that are used in anxiety. And so, you know, what's your thought process on modern medical treatment of anxiety?
I think that sometimes people need, let's talk about benzodiazepines, for example. I think sometimes people need benzodiazepines, these anti-anxiety meds, to get back down to a baseline, to be able to benefit mm-hmm. from the supports they need, whether that's therapy, could be spiritual counseling, could be whatever it is that is that person's support. But I think we mental health professionals have made some profound errors in how we've educated people about their use and how they've been radically overprescribed and pushed to such a degree that it's now, in terms of overdose deaths, benzodiazepine overdose deaths are the third, I think, leading cause of death right after two different kinds of opioids.
Yeah, so the fentanyl and OxyContin would have to take those top two spots.
You got it. So there's something that is wrong. And I think the fundamental thing that's wrong is that, again, we're in this business of dulling all pain. And it's no coincidence that opioids and anti-anxiety meds, physical and emotional pain, are these top overdose. We're in the business of dulling pain, so much so that we don't give people a chance to actually work through the pain. So benzodiazepines, as you know, I'm sure as a pharmacist, they were never meant to be a long-term solution. They're very dangerous. They have highly dangerous side effects and synergistic effects. Yep. They were meant and are clinically shown to be most effective when combined with evidence-based behavioral therapies and cognitive therapies. Mm-hmm. But yet they're just being prescribed like it's some sort of chill pill in your pocket. And so I think, again, this is on us. The onus is on us mental health professionals to have not told people, listen, benzos are like giving you a fish. You're going to eat for a day. But if you really want to eat for a lifetime, you need to learn how to fish. And that's cognitive behavioral therapies that help you build new skills, new coping, to look at yourself in a different light and the choices you're making in life. So I don't want people to feel like it's a failure if they've been on anti, or to take my message as, oh, you're taking medication, you're just suppressing your feelings, and that's a failure. That's the opposite of what I want to convey. I do want to convey that we have led people astray when it comes to how benzos and other, you know, psychotropic medications should be used.
Well, and as we've learned on this podcast, benzos, when they first came out, were intentionally, the marketing was intentionally manipulated to target women, target mothers, and to target
Mother's Little Helper,
Librium, the world's first million-dollar drug, created, in fact, by the grandfather of the masterminds of the opioid crisis that we are currently in. The Sackler family history goes back very long. And, you know, I think it's also, there's something changing, and maybe you can speak to this, because I think that a lot of people are being diagnosed with mental health conditions, that things seem to be on the rise. But one of the things that is so profound for me and my adult life, when I was a kid, I don't remember like mommy play dates that involved wine at noon. I don't remember like peeps getting together and acting like I need this anti-anxiety something to be an effective parent. And so what is shifting, and why are mental health problems on the rise? Or is it what you mentioned earlier, that we have the desire to basically describe, we want to validate. We want to validate the mental health. And oftentimes, I don't think people are satisfied unless they have the diagnosis, you know what I mean? So are they on the rise truly?
This is such a crucial question. because, you know, I've been a mental health professional for over 20 years. I actually defended my dissertation on September 11th, 2001, the 9/11. And I have seen, you know, at that time, it was such a, you know, our collective experience and trauma was so profound. And I thought, okay, this is the time to be a mental health professional. This is the time to work for these solutions. So put my head down for 20 years, did the research, a big focus on clinically validated treatments for anxiety and mental health, lowering barriers to access with digital therapeutics. And so I just looked up from, you know, I kind of lifted my head up and looked up about 5-6 years ago. And as you say, wait a second, the stats show us that mental health disorders are on the rise, with the biggest one of them being anxiety disorders. The stat, you know, any year about 18% of us could be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. In our lifetime, the stat is 1/3. That's the lifetime prevalence, which means over 100 million people in the US alone in their lifetime. So this is profound. So what went wrong? We have solutions, we have benzos, we have great self-help. And I think what went wrong is that we have become a culture, to your point, that equates mental health with the absence of any discomfort, that equates health with the absence of any discomfort. And we have these standards, almost these toxic standards of positivity, whereby unless we're fully optimized and everything is going perfect and everything is convenient, there's something wrong with our life. And we have lost sight of the fact that the price of a life well lived is actually to struggle through and to fall down and get back up. And so I think I think the increase in mental health diagnoses may be valid in one sense, but when you immediately medicate any emotional discomfort and slap on a diagnosis of a mental health disorder, then you start to wonder whether that's really as valid as you think. Our bar and our constraints have become so distorted for what counts. Now, I am glad we're having more acceptance and destigmatization of mental health and more conversations, but maybe we're having the wrong conversations.
You know, and this is a little bit of a controversial question. But one of the things also that is a new modern something in Western culture is this embodiment of the disease defines me. You know, we've got everybody, I'm a Lyme warrior, you know, Anxiety Awareness Month and this and that. And so how do we strike the balance between, yes, we want people who have anxiety as well as all mental health conditions, as well as all health conditions in general, to feel validated, to feel seen, to feel like their practitioners value them, that they're, you know, researching on their behalf and all of the things. But there's something that doesn't sit right with me when people define themselves by their illnesses. So how do we shift that conversation?
I think that's a crucial question. I think it's getting at the heart of what's going wrong with our mental health conversations. And I agree, it's a contentious topic. I think that, you know, let's think about it from a more medical perspective. So if I am a cancer survivor, I know it's often valuable to have that be a part of how you describe yourself or part of your journey. But I don't think anyone defines themselves as being like, I'm a person like who's fundamentally defined by being someone who had cancer, or that I am that cancer. And so, you know, or we could say, you know, I know you gave the Lyme disease, and that's sort of a challenge that's ongoing sometimes. But the problem with that is that we equate this as sort of, this is a trait now that's going to be invariant in our lives, that this is how I can both understand myself in this very uncertain world. It's how I can explain the times that I fail or can't do things. And maybe it's a way of when, again, not for everyone, but for some people, it may start to serve as that reason not to be uncomfortable, not to push yourself through, because, you know, I am an anxious person and I just can't do X, Y, Z. And listen, sometimes that might be the case. There are some cases in which people suffer from such debilitating illnesses, physical or mental illnesses, that it really is something that we have to support as a disability. But I think that's the vast minority. Mm-hmm. But that language has now been kind of painted over every single experience we have, even non-clinical experiences, of emotional distress. So that now everything is making me depressed. Everything is a trauma. Everything is a, and when we do that, we lose nuance and we lose the really important skill of telling the difference between a healthy experience of, say, anxiety or depression or grief, and really understanding when it is unhealthy. We just never get into that nuanced space anymore if we talk like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it goes back to Sheryl Sandberg's work. If everything is horrible, then you're not seeing the forest for the trees, you know, because you're just constantly in that repetitive mindset of like, well, just everything is bad. It's not true, friends. Everything is not bad.
And you have to, and it's a practice. So we also think that mental health, you have it or you don't. And again, that's why the disease metaphor isn't helpful, because yeah, you kind of do have cancer or you don't, or you have COVID or you don't. But with mental health, it really is an evolving, dynamic practice. So we are on a journey to mental health. It's not static.
Right.
It's not on or off. Just like the emotions that we have are not on or off. They're on dimmer switches.
Yes. I had bulimia growing up. I started my period really, really young. Didn't want to go to school while I was on my period. And my mom's like, yeah, you're going to be dealing with this like for a full week for like the next 40 years. So you're going to have to learn to go to school.
That's a tough one. Yeah.
It's a tough one for a fourth grader to take in, you know? And so I figured out that if I made myself throw up, I could come home from school when I was on my period. And so I had this diagnosis of bulimia around about like age 12 or 13, and it went with me until probably early college. And I credit, I took an SSRI antidepressant during that time, which helped to stabilize the binge eating. But I remember when I was going through eating disorder clinic and like learning about bulimia, there were so many authors that said, once you have bulimia, you have it for life. And I was just like, that's not true for me. That's not true for me. Like I had a moment of very distinct clarity where I saw a woman who I was like, she looks so sick and so underweight and just so, and I just said, you know what? I value myself more than that. I'm going to value myself more than this. I'm going to stop. And so I think I hope that gives some of our listeners hope that you may have anxiety, but you can work on putting it to work for you so that maybe it becomes, maybe you have less anxiety at some point in time. And talk to the parents who are listening, because you know, children, the competition among children have always been mean, but like the amount of exposure that children have these days is just next level. Like, how do parents raise anxious teens?
Oh, I have so much to say about this. I also have, and my poor kids, they are in this book with some of their anxious experiences. Many of my parenting fails. When it comes to this, but here's what I want to say about parenting and child anxiety. The title of my chapter that really focuses in on this question is called "Kids Are Not Fragile."
Mm-hmm.
And my goal here is really to share what I believe is a fundamental recalibration we parents need to make. And I'm in it. I have a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old. We feel that, you know, our kids are very fragile these days. We're very frightened for them because these are rough times. These are uncertain times. I mean, you can name any single thing in this world, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's school shootings, whether it's the American dream being not what we grew up with, certainly, climate change, everything you want to list. And so we, with the best of intentions, we want to protect our kids.
Mm-hmm.
We want to tell them, it's okay. We're going to, you know, I'm going to take care of this for you. But when it comes to kids and their emotional health, that's actually the opposite of what we should be doing, because we're so anxious about our kids' anxiety that we're starting to help them avoid building those skills they need to learn how to manage it. So there's a great study that came out of Yale Child Study Center a few years ago. They developed this new treatment for kids with clinical anxiety. It's called SPACE, Supportive Parenting for Anxious Kids. And they did a randomized clinical trial where they had one group of clinically anxious kids. So these were severely anxious kids. They received gold standard cognitive behavioral therapy, as you one normally would. The other half of the kids, they didn't give them any therapy. They gave the parents therapy, teaching them one skill, which was to stop over-accommodating their kids' fears. So if their kid had school anxiety and they let them stay home, the parents learned to gradually get that kid back in school and not let them stay home. If they wanted to sleep every night in the parents' bed because they had fears, the parent learned to get them, help them face those fears and get back into bed. And so they learned just to let their kids work through rather than around anxiety for about 6 or 8 weeks. And at the end of the study, they measured clinical anxiety symptoms. Kids who got CBT, nice reduction in anxiety. The kids who got no therapy, but their parents got SPACE, same magnitude of that same level of reduction in clinical anxiety in the kids. Now, what that shows us is not to parent blame, because I really am anti-parent blaming when it comes to this stuff. What it shows us is that we can trust our kids to have the fortitude to face many of these challenges. And maybe, and I think probably the best thing we can do to support and help our kids is to help them believe that they can work through these difficult feelings, that they're not too vulnerable and too fragile to do it, and to be their helpmates and their supports in that.
Absolutely. I mean, the rise of the helicopter parent is a very, very real phenomenon.
Oh, it's called snowplow parenting now. It's not even a helicopter. That's the hovering parent. Now the term is snowplowing, meaning they remove every obstacle to their kids' success, to any distress. So it's at another level now. So this is a trend.
Yeah. And I mean, you saying that just reminds me so much of the Lori Loughlin case, where she manipulated the system to pay for her daughter to go to USC. And it's like, your daughter didn't even want to go to college, you know? And it's like, well, why are we doing all of this snowplowing? And I love the space scenario, and encourage everybody to go check that out if you have parents and if you have anxious children. And what do parents do about social media with their kids?
Yeah, I think, listen, screens aren't going away. Mm-mm. They're also not all bad and they're not all good. So we're used to the headlines screaming one extreme or the other. But but the truth is they're here, and we, our job, I think, as parents is to prepare our kids to be digital citizens. So what does that mean? They need to gain skills in understanding the kinds of interactions they have online that feed them, and the ones that to understand what actually compromises them. So it's sort of like healthy eating, right?
Right.
Kids can learn. Even though they want to eat chips all day and it feels good in the moment, it's going to cost them later, and they need those healthy veg and fruit. And I think, I mean, that's an oversimplified analogy, but I think it's important, because what that tells us is that maybe the question we should be asking is not should they be on or off screens or exactly how much time, but what are they doing there? How are they living and experiencing life there? Mm-hmm. They should be educated that they're, you know, when it comes to social capital and gaining those social connection, social media is not going to give them that bonding.
Sure.
It can give them, you know, more social, you know, kind of branching and connecting and expressing yourself, but don't look there for the true social bonds. Also, don't look there for your identity, because you've been made a product. You are a product to be consumed and valued depending on how many likes and shares and followers you have. And that is not how self-development happens. We have to educate our children about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're not built as humans to live these disparate lifestyles. We're meant to be together. And, you know, as someone who branded myself as a brand more than a decade ago, I can understand why so many child actors go crazy and why they fly off the deep end, because it's a lot of expectation to live up to. And the person I am as a brand is not exactly who I am. You know, I am not the brand, but yet I am.
And the metrics that are put on top of you, that how do you judge who you are? Well, in normal self-development, we get to understand our connection to other human beings, our purpose in life. We discover all sorts of things. But on social media, all of that depth is flattened. And now what's incentivized? What are the metrics? Is what you said going to, you know, is it viral enough? Is it a clickbait enough? And if you're using those, so we're gamified to value those things. So if that's what we learned, I mean, how can you possibly understand what's really important to you or what's a purpose if the, if we're learning from a very young age to gauge ourselves by those metrics? I think that's fundamental. I'm more worried about that with social media exposure than any cyberbullying, any exposure to, you know, we're always going to socially compare. Teenagers socially compare. And I think that the comparisons out there are not great.
Right.
But I'm less worried about becoming, you know, developing an eating disorder because you're seeing other thin people than what it means for us as fundamentally as human beings to constantly be valuing ourselves on whether we're a consumed enough product as young developing human beings.
Yeah, that's really, really, really unhealthy. So I'd like to talk now about, like, what do you do? Like, how do you coach people to change these anxious behaviors?
There are so many, there are great tools out there. There's great therapy. There's great self-help. I don't even need to tell people, like, go to those, but you have to do something first. And that's really the fundamental kind of advice portion of my book. We have to change our mindset about anxiety before anything else can work.
Sure.
We have to break out of this disease mindset. So, you know, there's an elegant study that showed the power of this. We can use it in our daily life. So this was a study with socially anxious people. They were brought into the lab. Jameson and colleagues, about 2011, I think it was published. So it's a great study. And they were asked to do what's kryptonite for socially anxious people, which is to give a public speech without any time to prepare in front of a panel of judges.
Okay.
But they did something interesting. Half of those folks, again, social anxiety disorder with the fundamental fear of social humiliation. Half of those people were taught to think of their anxiety as not a sign that they were about to panic, but as a sign that they were preparing to perform at their best. So they were told, hey, when you get those butterflies in your stomach, when you sweat, when your heart races, that's your heart pumping blood and oxygen to your brain so you can focus. And here are five research studies that show that to be the case. And here's evolutionary theory, where even Darwin talked about emotions as being evolutionarily helpful. And so people just for 15, 20 minutes were trained to think differently about anxiety. And then the other half of folks weren't. And so what do you know when they did the speech, what happened? You measure their heart rate, you measure their blood pressure, and you see their performance. People who were taught to think of these feelings of anxiety, not as danger signals, but as signs of preparation, they perform better objectively in their speech. Their heart rates were lower and their blood pressure was lower. They looked like people who were primed to act. This is a tiny mindset shift, and we can do it over and over in our life if we start by being curious about anxiety, if we tune in and listen to it and consider that sometimes it can give us really helpful information about something we care about in the world. So that's definitely a step one. Mm-hmm. I want to acknowledge as a step two that sometimes anxiety isn't useful. So I have to always say that I'm like, anxiety is great. It's these things. It also sucks. It feels terrible. And sometimes it's useless to us. It's too free floating. It's too overwhelming. We can't always cope beautifully and perfectly with it. That's being human. And so in those times when it's not giving us useful information, like you're just too caught up in worries, you're too, let go and immerse yourself. Think about it as getting out of future tense gear and get back to the present moment. Let go of the future and do things that you probably already know how to do that help you immerse yourself in the present. For some people, that's exercising, listening to music. I love to write poetry, often very bad poetry, but it shifts my mindset, right? I love to spend time with my family or do something that helps you let go of the future and rejuvenate yourself. Yoga, see your therapist, talk to your best friend who always makes you feel like the world is right. Mm-hmm. We can do these things, come back to the present. And then when we're sort of ready, think, okay, if I still have this anxiety, if it hasn't gone away, how can I hitch my anxiety to a sense of purpose, to accomplishing something in my life that I care about, mm-hmm. whether it's big or small? Maybe I'm anxious about climate change. And I decide, you know what? I'm waking up every day with like ulcers, like worrying about this. Let me channel that to do something, to be an activist in this area. Or maybe you just want to eat healthier and you waking up realizing you don't feel good every morning. Use that anxiety to make better choices or help your kids make better choices. Mm-hmm. But when we think about it as being part of purpose instead of a disruptor of purpose, I think we will find those ways to use it and leverage it.
Oh, this is so brilliant. I am just so grateful that I was able to get my hands on a copy of your book, Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. And you saying that you write poetry, listeners, go back and listen to the Dr. Norm Rosenthal interview. If you recall, he's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who uses poetry as part of his cognitive behavioral therapy that he works with his patients on. To, you know, poetry is a very unique expression of the human experience and can be profound and life-changing. And so listeners, go and listen to that. Go pick up a copy of Dr. Tracy's book. You can find her work at drtracyphd.com and go pick up a copy of Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad, anywhere that you purchase books. So Dr. Tracy, thank you so much for coming in today and being a guest on The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Well, Lindsay, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thinx has launched a brand new line of period-absorbing underwear specifically for teens. Thinx teens are just as comfortable as regular underwear and can be worn alone or as a backup method with other period products for extra leak protection. They help to keep you dry by drawing away wetness and drying quickly. They help to neutralize odors, keeping you to feel fresh all day long. They're super absorbent and hold up to 5 tampons worth of flow. And they prevent leaks so that clothing, sheets, and everything else stays stain-free. The Thinx teens are reusable and simple to care for. All you have to do is machine wash them cold and hang them dry and don't expose them to either bleach or fabric softener. The Thinx teens do not feel bulky or wet, and they come in cute patterns that every teen will love. Head to lindsayelmore.com/Thinx. To shop sleep shorts, briefs, bikinis, and shorties that can help to absorb your period. I know for me, when I started my period, I was only in the 4th grade, and I learned very quickly that I didn't like it, and this was where I began to harm myself so that I could get out of school. Around the world, teens are ostracized and are more likely to miss school because of their periods. Let's get all of our young girls back in the classroom so that they have a better opportunity to excel in life. Get Thinx teens that are specifically designed for teen bodies today by heading to lindsayelmore.com/Thinx. That's THINX to save $10 off of your first order. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support The Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindsayelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag @Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.